Listeners, welcome to a special fast-tracked episode of the Judo Edit podcast. This is your host, Melissa Budiato, and today we will be speaking with triple Olympian Sabrina Filsmoser. As at the time of recording, Sabrina is 39 years old, but is not letting age stop her from chasing a fourth Olympic Games, or volunteering in Nepal, or learning to fly helicopters. She is truly an amazing woman, and you are in for a treat. Now, this episode was conducted as a live AMA in collaboration with the University of New South Wales Judo Club, and you will hear John Buckley, the high performance coach, also give his input throughout the interview. If you want to hear more from John Buckley, you can also see episode 5 of season 1 of this podcast. That man also has some great stories. And without further ado, here is Sabrina.
I was just saying that Sabrina's got an extremely long resume of success, a lot of gold medals, 3-time Olympian, and as of today, 25th of May, she's currently sitting at world number 28 and actually in a qualifying position for the Tokyo Olympics. You know, obviously everyone's got a starting point. Can you take us back to how did you get started with judo?
Yeah, hello all again. I just want to tell you how I started in my beginning. It was not like everybody else started in my area with 6-7 years. I started with around 9 years old. Before, I have been doing a lot of different sports, like outdoor sports. In Austria, here we have skiing, snowboarding. It's more, most of the kids want to do some winter sports because they get the sponsor or they just see it on TV. It's more popular here to do winter sports. So I started in a very young age with 2 or 3 years with skiing and snowboarding for sure. But then in I think the 3rd grade of school, we had this opportunity to go to a judo class just in our sweater. And there was a nice coach who showed us how judo worked. And we did a lot of games. We played around. We had a lot of fun. And I found it like, oh, it's pretty fun to do some different sport. Like I've never experienced before to fight somebody, to do like a kind of wrestling also with the boys. And after a few weeks, I could do some techniques. So I threw them and I could hold them. I had pretty good skills right from the beginning. And that's how I started judo with 9 years and competing with maybe 13 or 14 years.
Great, great. And so you mentioned that you started competing at 13 or 14 years. What was the very first competition you went to and how did you go?
I guess there were some competitions before in the club, but pretty serious competitions like on the national level was 14, 15. And there I never lost the fight. So somehow it affected myself and the first time I lost to a boy, I was pretty like down and not believing how I could lose it. But they explained to me he's like 1 year older than you, he's stronger than you, and it has more skills. But somehow from failure you learn more than from losses. And I was like really. I had to decide in this age, 14, 15 years, which kind of sport I should choose to do it seriously, because I did too many sports. I did like athletics and biking and cross-country skiing and snowboarding. But judo, yeah, there was more success than in other sports. I just stick to judo from 15 years. And with 16, I have been for the first time national champion in the juvenile category. Yeah, this was the time when I knew, okay, it will be judo.
Yeah, wow. That's a pretty fast progression. And I love that you're just fighting boys and can't stand to lose.
I thought you'd like that, yeah.
Okay, so one of the recent achievements, I guess, that you've had. So last year you became the oldest person, male or female, to ever win a medal at an IJF competition by placing 3rd at the Baku Grand Prix. So what was it like to win that medal and can you remember how it happened?
Yeah, in the beginning I didn't recognize I'm the oldest person. I just very happy about it to win a medal, because I had a long time without any major success. I did a lot of different things like education and flying around, but I trained really hard, and I was sure if I really take it seriously again, I'm able to go for the qualification till the Tokyo Games. So
yeah.
On the way, you need a medal or more medals to qualify somehow. And so because this competition was so emotionally for myself, my national team coach, he couldn't go there. It was in Budapest, Grand Prix in Budapest, because he had some family troubles. So I asked my Olympic Center coach, who John all knows him. His name is Klaus-Peter Stolberg. He's in charge of my daily training, my daily routine. And he had the chance to go with me to Budapest, because the national team coach was not able to do. So I had this strong emotional feeling to somehow give everything, like, because I really felt well during the preparation, during the warm-up. I knew it's a perfect day to get a medal. And yeah, somehow it worked. And that's why it was really emotional for myself, for everybody, and for my coach. And yeah, I was really very surprised afterwards how many people congratulated and voted. I was all over TV in Austria, and I for me it was just a medal, you know, in a
yeah, of course. Of course. But like for us, if you compare across sports, you're right up there with Federer, you know?
Yeah. after the competition, there was this guy from the IGF. He came to me and said, "Oh my god, you're the oldest person who ever won a Grand Prix medal." And I'm the oldest. Okay. You know, it was not like about the age.
Mm-hmm. It's always just been about working hard and getting results for you.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So over the years, what's inspired you to keep training hard and chasing that dream and chasing the gold medals?
There are many points which kept my motivation to follow this Olympic dream. I have a lot of reflections from different competitions, from different atmospheres in different countries, from different cultures. And I like to take this atmosphere to always set my goals, my aims very high. If there is one aim done, it's done, but I need another challenge. I need another big aim to follow. But this dream of an Olympic medal kept everything alive. Like I did different studies, I did like so many things in my life. I had the chance to do it, and I'm very thankful for that. But the dream of an Olympic medal, even if I'm not able to do it, it kept everything alive.
Yeah. And is that what you're thinking about before you go into like a hard randori session?
No, like the hard training is part of my daily routine. If I don't have the challenge during the day to do something for my body and my mind, it's just a lost day. I mean, if on the schedule there are like one day off, or you need to regenerate as many hours as the sport science tells you, I don't follow this exactly, you know? And my coaches, they know it. If I go to climb a mountain or I do a bike ride, I just write down regeneration bike ride. And everybody knows I like 10 hours climbing somewhere in the mountain. But they know this, and they know myself, and that's what kept me like really possible to do it in such a high age. I'm still fit enough. I mean, there are some problems always, but that's true. You have some small injuries, you have some serious injuries, but if you go through it, it's the same about failures. If you don't fail and you don't learn how to fail and to use this energy to build up again your motivation and your way of getting to the aim, even if you have like ups and downs and curves, yeah, I think that's the way. I also had to learn it. I didn't knew it from the beginning. It is just step by step to recognize there are limitations you have to accept. But if you overcome some different limitations, you go through it. You learn how to deal with it. And that's what kept my dream alive about the Olympics.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And I wanted to actually start asking some of the listener questions because everyone's got a lot of really good questions here.
Yeah.
So one of the first ones at the beginning from Lincoln and from Nick, they're asking, do you ever feel nervous right before a fight?
Oh, I do. It doesn't matter how old you are nervous. But you need this kind of nervosity to be like in the moment. If you are just too relaxed, you don't have the tension to go to the mat and to be like in the now. If I'm overstressed or like the pulse rate is too high, I will have for sure some mistakes and I do some stupid things, you cannot hear your coach, which gives you good advices, or you cannot recognize the moment to change something in your tactics. But you need this kind of being prepared to step on a mat, and then you just let it flow and you fight.
Yeah.
The time before, to be like in a good way, a little nervous, like high tension.
Mm-hmm.
It's necessary. I don't, and you have to accept it. If you don't have it, if you're too loose, it will not work. Not in my case.
Yeah. And I guess the follow-up question from that is, how do you warm up for your competitions? Do you have a process? Does it change or is it the same every time?
It's nearly the same every time. During the years, for sure, there are some different things which I changed, but it's a very hard warm-up. I want to be prepared. I want to have a fight before I really go into the real competition. I need to do strong grip. I need to be like one time over the limit to get all the lactate outside, then calm down like 20 minutes before and getting ready for the competition. But I do like 40 to 45 minutes warm up.
Mm-hmm. And I guess leading into this competition, Ryan Koenig is asking, when you're cutting weight, do you have any tips on how to make it easier?
It's never easy.
What are your secrets?
The secret is it's a challenge every time. No, if it's not a challenge, I'm not prepared. I even tried to change something when I was like 29 years old. I had a world championships in Rotterdam and was like devastated. I lost first round and was really done. And so I wanted to change the weight category to move up to 63. And I did like 3-4 months really hard weight training, all in the gym, no stamina, no conditioning, which for me is like fun. I love to ride a bike. I love to run. I go up the mountains. But during this period, they said, go into the gym and do build up muscles. And I felt really strong. Mm-hmm. I had like 3 kilograms, which is way too low for 63 kilogram girl fighters. They're like 5-6 kilogram more. Yes. So I felt okay. I felt like ready to fight, but they had so much more power on the mm-hmm. high level. So I went down 1 month afterwards, even if I took some medals, but I went down for the European Championships in Vienna 2010, and I took a medal in the European Championships level, 57 kilograms. And I said to myself, okay, that's my category. However, you need this kind of preparation 1 week before to cut the weight, to be prepared, to have the tension, to be ready in such a condition, to be hungry to fight. And in the 60 kilogram category, it was just fun. I mean, well, it's good to be strong and to step on the mat, but you don't have the reaction. You don't have the quickness, the speed, the fast movements, which makes it so difficult. Like when you cut the weight, you are in a very special condition. You're hungry to fight, even if you sometimes you feel tired. But mm-hmm. if you step on the mat, you're ready.
And
do it for many, many times, and it gets like a routine. It's the same. You have to train for it to cut the weight in a healthy, serious way.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I love that you're harnessing that challenge as part of your mindset to build your competitive drive. That's so awesome. On a bit of a lighter note, Dasha, she's asking, what is your favorite lolly? So maybe after you've made weight, what's your favorite lolly?
I'm not sure if I understand the word lolly right.
Sweet. A candy or a sweet.
A chocolate, a sweet, yeah.
We have a lot of very delicious sweets in Austria. I don't maybe John knows it. Everybody here up in the mountains, they eat a lot of sweet desserts, like kind of pancakes, cut it with sugar and honey and whatever. But my favorite sweet dish is ice cream. I love it. So I have a ice shop here near the Olympic Center, and they make this special ice cream called what it's called, with honey and poppy seed.
Okay.
I like all kinds of sweets.
That sounds so delicious, and now you're making me hungry. So we better move on to a different topic. Okay, John is asking, what is your favorite technique and what is your secret to execute it to perfection?
Yeah, if I tell you my secret, I love to do uchimata. Now, because I'm older, it's not that easy to throw in the right moment. My reactions are not so fast than when I've been young. But I still love this kind of technique because it's on one foot. You can enter from different angles. You can pull in different variations. You can throw like mysteriously from... Yeah. Different positions, but the secret to throw it is just the kutsushi. I would say the timing and the reaction comes out of the kutsushi. And if you have the right moment, it doesn't matter where you stand, which position, which angle, what's the power of my opponent, if she or he is like three times more powerful, it doesn't matter because it's just the right timing.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I'm going to throw in one of my questions here because I'm genuinely curious about this. But in watching your fights and watching your videos of your wins especially, you're very quick to see opportunities in Newaza. How have you trained yourself to be able to find and set up opportunities for like a strangle or for a hold down? What's your process with Newaza?
I guess somehow it's the only way where I can really go for a nippon in my mind, because I'm such a long player. I have long arms, long legs, and it's difficult to throw powerful people without having the same power, you know. That's why I try to put all my energy in the transition. And the most important thing during the transition is to be quick and ready to accept, now it's going into Newaza. If my opponent knows, oh, she's dangerous in Newaza, they always want to escape. But if your mindset is more on the transition than on the Newaza itself, there is enough time for everything. You do the transition fast and then you have time for Newaza, because the other one is always in the defending position. They want to escape and they want to hide and they want to like go back to Netachibaza. And if you have this kind of feeling, you have all the time in the world. But the quickness in the transition is the most important thing, I would say.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
I learned it. Yeah, because I had to find a way to win. Otherwise, if there is no Newaza, I will have not one chance to win, because it's difficult to throw the people, to walk for a good uchimata or uchi or whatever, which I always want. I mean, I want to throw, but it's difficult to get people which are stronger than you, faster than you, quicker than you, into a defensive position in Tachibaza. So I have to use my mind and my optimistic focus on the Newaza to put them down.
That's yeah, all. fast in the transition, and that creates time for no other. I like it. So one of the next questions is actually asked by both Kira Hughes. So hi, Kira, and from Marietta. Hi, Marietta. And they are asking, when you're injured, how do you keep connected with people? And I guess, how do you keep training at a high level when injuries are so common in judo?
That's not an easy question to answer, because during the many years I had too many injuries, really serious injuries. I had a lot of surgeries, but also there are small injuries. And the difference between small and more serious injuries is just the time which you need to get back into judo shape, into walking on the tatami. I would say the small injuries should be part of your judo life. You don't talk too much about it. You just tape it. You see the others do the same. If you ever walked out in Japan, you know everybody's taping. They have small injuries, they tape it. So you try to do the same and go on and keep on going. If there is some pain, you put some ice, you have a physio or whatever. But if there is a serious injury, you have to find something to keep your mind in balance. I would say that's my really good point in my case. I always found something which kept my mind working, to have a new challenge, to have some studies, to go into university, to finish something, to start maybe some other hobbies, some other kind of sport. You learn during your physio, your therapy, different things. Your mind and your body opens. That's the advantage of an injury. It's always an advantage, because you get more possibilities to learn about new things. If you get adjusted to it, you take the positive things and the negative things away. But it helps you to be more open-minded, to get to know other people, maybe other cultures if you travel. In my way, it always helped me to open up and to be more motivated afterwards, to focus on the goal which I had before. It was like I was traveling, I was climbing, I was going to Nepal, to Bhutan. I did some studies at university. But there have been like 20 serious injuries in my whole career. So there was a lot of time, and I just used it.
Yeah. Wow. That's so awesome. I love that you see the opportunities in everything, and you're using it as a positive point in your life. One of the things that you just also touched upon there, and a couple of people have asked about, so Paul Nelson, give us a wave, and Heidi, give us a wave. They would like to ask about the work you've been doing in Nepal and the volunteer work there. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I would love to tell you more about it, because it's something like, I mean, people there are already like family. When I've been for the first time in Nepal, I have been there 2005, I was just there to experience the high altitude. I wanted to climb mountains. I wanted to climb the highest mountains in the world. I knew about their culture, but I didn't like expect too much, because it's a tourist season. It's like very touristy in the Everest region. But people changed my mind there. They were so curious, and they were like friendly from morning till evening. And even if they had like really hard life, they grow potatoes outside on the stony soil, and they eat the same dish, dal bhat, every day. But they are always smiling the whole day, even if it's like hard life and they don't have any medical treatment or some help, some insurance. And I learned a lot there. And when I realized there are already some judo projects in Kathmandu at some orphanages, I was like thinking about, maybe we can help. I can collect some judo gis back at home. They need it. If they help together and they grow some clubs and they do more work there, I could help in the orphanages. And even I was like dreaming of this Everest judo club to build with a friend. During the years, we did a lot of projects, and we have now a lot of friends working together. And now we have this Everest Judo Club project. We have different clubs in all over this Khumbu area in Kathmandu and also in Bhutan. Bhutan is a small country between India and Nepal, and on the north is Tibet. Mm-hmm. And they already had Pelk Hill School, a small dojo with maybe 30, 40 people, where there was a Japanese coach who taught them from the beginning on a very high level, like quality Japanese judo. And when I've been there for the first time, I was like mind blown because they do better judo than most of our players in Austria at this age, like 7, 8 years on. And again, I went there with a lot of equipment, like say 250 kilogram equipment. I flew there, I provided it, and they were so happy and they had like so much fun with it. Now the Tokai University is also supporting them, and the Japanese Federation sent some coaches there, and yeah, it's growing. They are already part of the IGF now, and two of them got a scholarship in Hokkaido University in Japan. So probably we will see the first two Bhutanese fighters in the Olympic Games in Tokyo. It's
fantastic.
Wow.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it was like, and I've never thought about it if it's possible, but then I realized, oh, there are some projects and some scholarships. Maybe it's possible to get the attention from the IGF, and now it's working. It's really cool.
Wow. So you can directly see the output from your work there. That's so amazing.
Maybe one very good story I want to tell you about the first judo player who was carrying the Nepalese flag in the Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. Her name is Pupu Khatri, and her father died in an avalanche accident up to Khumbu Icefall when they prepared the way up to Everest in 2013. And I knew these Sherpa people because I was climbing all the time with them, and I knew they have no insurance. They put all the hard work and work like 2 or 3 months a year to climb Everest with all the clients. And yeah, he died during this avalanche accident together with 22 other Sherpas, and the government had no payment for their family. They didn't get any money, so because they had no insurance and they didn't find the bodies of the Sherpas who died in the avalanche, they are not declared as dead. So that's why the family has to wait 10 years to get some money from the government. It's crazy, but now it's better. They got some insurance after this accident, but during this time we had the chance to help together. And Pupu Khatri was the oldest daughter. She went to an orphanage in Kathmandu where we had this judo project, and she started judo there. She was pretty good, very strong, because they are very strong if they live up there in the mountains and they can carry a lot. Yeah, it happened. She got like a medal in the Asian junior championships, and she was the first one who could carry the flag in the Olympic Games in Rio for Nepal. She was judo player and out project. That's very nice.
Oh, I love that. Sabrina, that's such a great story.
Sabrina, just on that note, some of the people who are tuned in will know about your recent GoFundMe project, but some people may not. So maybe we can make sure that we get that out to the people who are tuned in, because that's a fantastic story. I know some of the things you've done. And guys, these people, if you see some of the photographs, you wouldn't believe it. You may think your dojo is a bit rough. It's nothing compared to what these people are doing, and they're practicing judo. It's amazing.
Even awesome. If it's now a very small project, because I started it together with a club in Auckland in the United States. I've never done a GoFundMe or crowdfunding because I didn't want it. But I think the idea is really, really good.
It's a very worthy cause. I mean, we talk about the judo family, but this is a real perfect expression of what the judo family can do. It's amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, one thing, like the Tokai University, they will now finance to deliver some tatamis to the Everest Judo Club in an altitude of nearly 4,000 meters. My club now is a 2,800 meters. But when the kids there go to the next school, to high school, they have to climb up to 4,000 meters to...
So are they going to airdrop the tatami or something?
Yeah, that's the problem. The tatamis itself, they are not so expensive, but we have to take them from Japan to Kathmandu, which will be paid by the Tokai University. But wow. Then from Kathmandu to Lukla, you need an airplane, and from Lukla up to the school, you need a helicopter.
Wow.
Very expensive. 3 days long, so it's a hard way.
Yeah, for sure. Hayden is asking, do they do judo in schools in Austria? Is it a school sport?
It's not a school sport, but we have some schools here, also in Upper Austria, where you have the possibility to choose judo as your free sport. So maybe two schools offer judo practice once a day for 1.5 or 2 hours. But it's not a school sport in all schools. Also in Vienna, we have some schools where you can train judo once a week, but it's not a school sport. It's just some projects.
Yeah, I see. And so we've had a couple of people asking here. I think Marietta and Leon are asking around the world in terms of your competitions, do you have a most formidable opponent? If you're able to say, or I don't know if that gives away a competitive advantage or not, you don't have to answer it. Or maybe someone in the past, or
I guess because I'm so many years there have been some opponents which were pretty nasty, pretty strong, pretty challenging. But I remember one girl, which I will never, ever forget. I still have contact with her. It's Kaori Matsumoto.
She's of course.
It's a woman.
I was training with her many times at Teikyo University. We did like a lot of uchikomi, a lot of randaris. So we knew each other very well.
Mm-hmm.
For her, it was such, really a big challenge to fight me in randori, because she was not used to fight so big girls, like with long legs, long arms. But she wanted to fight me every day because nobody in Japan who has the same size. And she knew in the international competitions, there are like Pavia or other girls where she have to be prepared. That what changed somehow my mind, because everybody else was just like, oh, okay, maybe that's difficult, but I don't need to take this challenge. But Matsumoto was always taking the challenge to learn each session for learning, for studying. She also showed me some things and she showed me some moves. She didn't explain too much, but that was really, really like you didn't need to speak about it. It was just a strong bond between us.
Yes.
We fought when she was still junior, we fought our first competition in a World Cup in Sofia, where I won on the ground. And I forgot this situation. I was just thinking about, oh, it was a Japanese fighter. But she told me afterwards, this loss was so important for her whole career, because it took her so many years to overcome this and to be strong. In Japan, it's like, you will not believe, but if they go outside of their country and they will lose their first fight in their first tournament, it's devastating news. Sometimes they don't pick you for another tournament. So if you don't go really, really hard in training and give everything, you will not be picked to go to the next tournament. Yeah. For her, it was a lesson. And I remember the last fight I fought her in the Masters in Morocco. She was already Olympic champion. But she had always this kind of respect, and because we knew each other so well, she lost again with some ashiwaza. But afterwards, she was like choking around, and she didn't take it seriously. I mean, it was like hard for her. But we always, when we meet, she has now an ice cream shop. That's another thing which we have in common. She loves ice cream, so she opened up an ice cream shop. And we always speak about it, and we speak about her family now, but it's somehow a very good nice experience to get some friends.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, that's such a great story. JB, you wanted to say something?
Oh, I'm just going to say, I'm just checking with Heidi. I see we've only got about 4 minutes to go. Is that correct?
Yeah.
We've got one question left. Is that okay?
Yeah, go. I just want to wrap it up at the end.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess this is sort of a joint question from Warren Rosser and Roman. What are your current hobbies outside of judo, and what do you see yourself doing after judo competitions have finished?
That's not very difficult. It's easy. I love to climb mountains. I love to do skiing, biking, outdoors. We are very lucky. We have beautiful mountains, beautiful landscape here in Austria. Whatever will bring the future. Maybe I go again to Nepal, to Bhutan to help in my development projects. I also love to fly. I have a fixed wing pilot license, and I try to get the helicopter add-on, but there are a lot of dreams and a lot of things I want to realize after Tokyo.
Yep. Excellent. Okay. Look, we're going to run out of time in just a moment, but let me just wrap it up for a moment. I'm sure, Sabrina, I speak for everyone. This has been truly amazing, this session. The judo circuit was great, but even better, I think, is hearing some of your thoughts, your emotions, how you approach the sport. As I say, you've been an inspiration to so many people, and I'm sure the people who have been tuned in tonight will now have a different view of what they see when they see people like you fighting at the international level. You've given us some terrific insights in everything from making weight to warming up to your mental preparation. It's so valuable, and we can't thank you enough.
Listeners, I hope you enjoyed that special episode with Sabrina Filsmoser. If you want to contribute to the judo club which Sabrina has started in Nepal on the side of a mountain, the link to the GoFundMe is in the description, so please go and check that out and donate if you can. Otherwise, thank you for your ratings, reviews, and messages of support for this podcast. It means a lot to me and inspires me to keep going, tracking down and interviewing these high-performance judo athletes. Until next time, this is Melissa Budiato signing off.